You're doing a lot of shopping this holiday season, but are you saving a lot? With Rakuten, you can save big on holiday gifts from your favorite brands. They give shoppers like you cash back on top of the biggest sales of the year. Earn cash back at Target, Ulta, and Lowe's. Rakuten even helps you find the best coupons, deals, and sales. Just start your shopping with Rakuten to save money at over 3,700 stores. Join for free at Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app. That's Rakuten.
I'm Mo Rocca, and I'm excited to announce season 4 of my podcast, Mobituaries. I've got a whole new bunch of stories to share with you about the most fascinating people and things who are no longer with us. From famous figures who died on the very same day to the things I wish would die, like buffets. Listen to Mobituaries with Mo Rocca on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning. I'm Jane Pauley, and this is a special edition of Sunday Morning, our annual food issue. This week, as family and friends gather for Thanksgiving, food, of course, is the main attraction. And so it is for us this morning. The big meal we'll serve Thursday is especially beloved because it's so rooted in tradition. But as David Pogue will explain, elsewhere in the food world, it's all about the search for what's new and different.
Our tastes in food are always changing.
Ever eat a pine tree?
We see a big trend in heat. People are just craving it.
Less additives, pure ingredients.
Mushrooms are really having a moment right now.
Who determines the hot new trends in food? And who turns the trends into food you can buy? Coming up on Sunday Morning.
To hear music great Garth Brooks tell it, nothing brings people together quite like good music with maybe a side of beer, which helps explain his new Nashville night spot. Friends in Low Places was a number one country hit for Garth Brooks in 1990. Now it's a Nashville bar and honky-tonk.
Oh, look at that. That's great.
Is that the first one?
That's the very first one.
One slide?
Ahead. Country music superstar and honky-tonk proprietor, Garth Brooks. Hey,
that's a two-step. You were a good student.
It'll make a better still picture than... You may know the popular TV series The Bear for its colorful cast, but Tracy Smith tells us the hit series features an equally prominent and beefy co-star, what may be Chicago's most beloved sandwich.
We're down 6 sausage, pepper, 5 greens, and a ravioli. Let's go.
The TV show about a Chicago beef joint is pure fiction.
Hands, please!
Here's a Polish and a mod stick.
But it's based on a real-life place where the food is pure heaven.
Later on Sunday Morning, have we got a meaty story for you. I need hands!
Thank you.
And there's much more on our menu.
You might say from soup to nuts, make that from sardines to pawpaws on our Sunday Morning food issue.
And we'll be right back.
Almost a century ago, a murder-suicide rocked a quiet London neighborhood. But there's a lot more to this story, and I'm documenting my investigation in the new podcast, Ghost Story. Ghosts aren't real. At least that's what I've always believed. Sure, odd things happened in my childhood bedroom, but ultimately, I shrugged it all off. That is, until a couple of years ago, when I discovered that every subsequent occupant of that house is convinced they've experienced something inexplicable too, including the most recent inhabitant who says she was visited at night by the ghost of a faceless woman. It just so happens that the alleged ghost haunting my childhood room might just be my wife's great-grandmother, who was murdered in the house next door by 2 gunshots to the face. Ghost Story, a podcast about family secrets, overwhelming coincidence, and the things that come back to haunt us. Follow Ghost Story on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Hi, it's me, the Grand Poobah of Bah Humbug, the OG Green Grump, the Grinch. From Wondery, 'Tis the Grinch Holiday Talk Show is a pathetic attempt by the people of Whoville to use my situation as a teachable moment. So join me, the Grinch, along with Cindy Lou Who.
Hello, everyone.
And of course, my dog, Max. Every week for this complete waste of time. Listen as I launch a campaign against Christmas cheer, grilling celebrity guests like chestnuts on an open fire. They'll try to get my heart to grow a few sizes, but it's not gonna work, honey. Your family will love the show. As you know, I'm famously great with kids.
Follow Tis the Grinch Holiday Talk Show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Tis the Grinch Holiday Talk Show early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
As we gear up for the big Thanksgiving meal, we may experiment with a new dish or two or try a twist on an old one. But if you're a food maker, that's standard practice all year long. David Pogue tells us about the taste makers tempting America's palate.
Since the dawn of dinner, food fads have formed and fizzled.
Mother Murphy, lucky me. My wife uses Swanson TV turkey dinners.
But who's behind them?
Would they ever come to you and say, hey, you're the trend people. What should we be developing for market next year?
That's what they do all the time.
Sherry Fry is an insights executive at Nielsen IQ in Chicago, a spinoff from the Nielsen TV ratings company. She analyzes the public's food purchases and spots the trends. These days, here's the big one.
Consumers are savvier than ever about what they're putting in their bodies and the impact that it has on their health, but also the health of the planet overall.
Not all of the trends will strike you as obvious, like the spike in mushrooms.
We're seeing this in beverages. We're seeing it in baked goods, shiitake salad dressing.
And sea vegetables.
It's time to eat more kelp.
Kelp burgers and just a variety of seaweed chips and snacks that we're finding.
And ingredients thought to lower your stress levels, like ashwagandha.
So it's possible that in 2024, I might see a favorite sports drink now with ashwagandha.
You already do. Yes.
When a food company embraces a trend by introducing a new product, here's a big secret. Sometimes they outsource the recipe.
I would imagine that DiGiorno or Mrs. Fields has their own chefs, but obviously you're helping them out.
Sometimes they're trying to get into new space and they don't know quite how to do that. And they'll come and ask for our help.
Why? Because it's often more efficient just to hire Matson, a food development lab near San Francisco.
Yeah, this is the greatest hits hall.
Katie Hagen is Matson's insights executive. But how does Matson know where tastes are going? By watching the young people.
If you ask a Gen Z, what's their favorite food? What are they going to say?
Mexican.
And then second is Chinese.
Yeah.
And you also have a rising Hispanic population in the United States, which feeds into the desire for Latin cuisines as well.
On the day we visited, Matson scientists were working on a new line of protein-infused coffee.
All right, we are starting with pH formulation A. Okay.
It's a lot of trial and error.
And keto empanadas, meaning low-carb, high-fat. Their first attempt wasn't a hit.
Okay, first of all, it's a little mushy. We weren't able to get to the right type of dough.
6 months later.
My colleague here has conducted over 100 different formulas to get to this.
That's really good. What am I missing because it's keto?
Hopefully nothing.
Well, I don't know about you, but I smell hit.
Matson client Lance Lively works for a precision fermentation startup. He and Matson innovation chief Barb Stuckey served me breakfast.
We are working on the future of food.
Are you telling me this is not real eggs?
The egg that you're eating right now does, in fact, contain real egg protein. But here's the thing. The egg protein did not come from a chicken.
Nobody in a million years would say this didn't come from an egg.
Our egg protein comes from yeast. No cholesterol and no saturated fats.
So why don't we want the actual chicken eggs?
the way that we need to think about producing food in the future has to change. We're going to have too many humans on Earth, and we're not going to have enough land, we're not going to have enough water.
And so we're able to produce completely indistinguishable products at a fraction of the sustainability impact.
The goal for a new product is awareness and memorability.
That's what Campbell's soups are.
Good.
You know, good, memorable.
Finally, before a new food can become a hit, it has to be advertised.
We have our awards.
Andrew Swinand is the CEO of Leo Burnett in Chicago, the agency behind some of history's most famous ad campaigns.
They're great!
Leo Burnett came up with their great.
From the Valley of the Jolly.
Ho, ho, ho.
Green Giant.
Jolly Green Giant. So some of the most iconic characters in the industry.
So let's say I've invented a new keto mushroom-based lemonade, and I want to hire you.
Decades ago, you would do a TV ad and run it, and you'd be able to reach 50% of the U.S. Today, a lot of it is social.
He means social media. These days, you have to generate buzz online.
It can be difficult to navigate.
For example, to promote Bare Naked Granola, the agency mapped trails that are friendly to naked hikers.
Bare peach check means friendly.
That must have worked on social.
Incredibly successful.
And so, in the new year, the tastemakers will be giving us food that's healthier and better for the planet, more Mexican and Asian food, and
it is in products across the store.
According to Nielsen IQ's Sherry Fry, more pumpkin spice.
This is a 20-year trend.
But it actually looks like it's still going up. When does it peak?
We're asked this every year about what's happening with pumpkin spice. I think we're all wondering if there'll ever be a point that it'll peak.
Would someone years. Explain this? People make fun of pumpkin spice.
I'm CBS News correspondent Major Garrett, host of the podcast Agent of Betrayal, The Double Life of Robert Hansen. During the Cold War, FBI agent Robert Hansen traded classified secrets to the Kremlin in exchange for cash and jewels. In the podcast, you'll hear from Hansen's closest friends, family members, victims, and colleagues for the most comprehensive telling of who Robert Hansen really was. Binge the entire series now. Agent of Betrayal, The Double Life of Robert Hansen is available on the Wondery app, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Did you know that kids eat 1,095 meals every year? And if you include snacks, it's more like 4 trillion meals a year. Honestly, the responsibility kind of sucks sometimes, but we're here with some real help and camaraderie too. We're Stacy and Megan, hosts of Didn't I Just Feed You, a weekly podcast that gets real about what it takes to feed our families. Tune in to Didn't I Just Feed You for kitchen tricks, product recommendations, and tons of meal ideas, like how to turn nachos into a legit family dinner. Listen to Didn't I Just Feed You wherever you get your podcasts.
Lee Cowan is sampling some hot trends in barbecue with flavors from lands far from our shores.
She is perhaps one of the lesser-known ancient Egyptian goddesses. Her name is Hesat. Depicted as a cow, she was worshipped as the goddess of nourishment. So perhaps it's not that much of a surprise that a cow goddess and barbecue would eventually meet.
Oh, man.
This is KG Barbecue in Austin, Texas.
The rice bowl is a great introduction.
Where pitmaster Kareem Al-Gayesh has blended the flavors of ancient Egypt with an age-old cowboy tradition.
It's a combo I've never heard of before.
Yeah, I've never seen pomegranate seeds on barbecue.
Mm-hmm.
His presentation is as unique as the taste. Each dish looks like a landscape, painted with the vibrant colors of the Middle East. Meats of all sorts, including lamb and kofta sausages, are seasoned with cumin, coriander, and turmeric.
My goal was to present something that looks familiar, but then you go and try it, and it's an explosion of flavors.
Kareem first came to Texas from Cairo on a whim.
I mean, I know Western movies, I know cowboys, I know country music.
He never tasted Texas barbecue, but when he did, recreating it for himself became his life's work.
Sounds like you became a little obsessed with figuring out how to do
just
it.
Just a little bit, yeah.
Just a little bit.
He was a finance executive back in Cairo, where in his spare time he would go searching for a cut of brisket to try his hand at his newfound love.
I would go with the cow chart, you know, on my phone. This is where the brisket is. Like, can you cut it?
10 years after his very first taste of Texas barbecue, Kareem opened his own food truck. And within months, his Egyptian-style barbecue had earned a nomination for a prestigious James Beard Award.
Don't ask me how.
I think it's beautiful. I think it's like a work of art. I can't wait to eat this.
I really think a lot of the immigrants who are coming to Texas specifically see barbecue as a way, like a palate, to bring the flavors of their culture to the forefront.
That's Daniel Vaughn, the highly influential barbecue editor for Texas Monthly.
We got crispy pigskin right here.
Oh, yes.
We found him at the magazine's annual barbecue fest in Lockhart this month.
Oh, that's the good sound right there.
Hovering around a whole pig being prepared by Don Nguyen, who, along with his brother Theo, started a Vietnamese-style pop-up in Houston called Koi Barbecue.
What I'm kind of doing on top is just a little fried onion oil.
This dish, for example, offers pork shoulder on a bed of vermicelli noodles, then flavored with a Vietnamese fish sauce.
This is spot on right here.
You ever tasted anything like this?
No, that's unique.
I see people who sort of rail against the idea of all these changes in Texas barbecue, but when you sit them down with that plate in front of them, they're rarely arguing about whether it's good or not, right?
They're certainly lining up at this Asian-styled Texas smokehouse called Kamuri Tatsuya, also in Austin. Chef Tatsu Aikawa is Tokyo-born, but he's Texas-raised. So he doesn't see his barbecue as some kind of trendy fusion. To him, it's just as natural as pairing salt and pepper.
What I make is, it just comes through me, you know, as an experience. That's why I don't like to use the word fusion. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think to me, it's deeper than that.
He too has been racking up awards for items like his barbecue bento box. Diners can take brisket, put it on a bed of rice and garlic, wrap it in nori, and then just eat it like a hand roll.
Good.
Then there's this hugely popular ramen dish, where barbecue brisket is served atop thick, slurp-worthy noodles, accompanied with a pork bone broth for dipping.
It kind of creates this thickness where it kind of coats the whole noodle. Texas barbecue is almost perfect, you know, to its form, and I respect it. So to me, I'm just creating vehicle to showcase and highlight. I'm not trying to alter what it is.
These are about maybe 6-7 hours in.
Neither is Kareem El-Gayesh.
I'm just someone that followed my brain. You know, I'm like, this is what I want to do, so I'm just going to do it.
Follow your heart, I guess.
Yeah, follow my heart, too. Exactly, follow my heart.
He just got his U.S. citizenship this year, and so now he proudly wears an American flag on his barbecue apron, right next to his Egyptian pendant. A Texan by way of Cairo, who just put a few more notches in the nation's barbecue belt.
I love introducing people to Egypt and its food and its culture. And it's a great way to do it through Texas barbecue.
This is Stephen Colbert, here to talk to you about The Late Show Pod Show, which is our podcast of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. I'm here with my producer, Becca. Becca, what can people expect on the podcast?
The extended moments, for sure.
For instance, if I'm talking to Tom Hanks for like 20 minutes, only 14 of that ever makes it to air because we just don't have time. And Tom's a jabberjaw. You know, he's a chatty Cathy. But it's all gold because it's Tom Hanks, and we put that on the podcast.
We do.
Yeah, that's value added. Listen to The Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert wherever you get your podcasts.
All through the morning, Serena Ulcha will be sampling some tools of the trade indispensable to cooks across America. She starts us off on the cutting edge.
For Quentin Middleton, a meal is only as good as the tools used to make it.
My knives are very nimble and thin, so it zips right through the food like a Ferrari.
About 50 miles north of Charleston, Middleton crafts chef's knives by hand, a precise process that can take over 8 hours and involves everything from forging metal to fine-tuning handles. A Middleton-made knife can cost up to $2,500.
Each knife decides what it wants to wear. So if I'm pouring myself into a knife and I'm putting everything into my thoughts, my feeling, my love, that item needs to tell me, okay, I want a green handle, I want a blue handle.
Middleton's love for knives started at the swing set.
And I would take a cinder block and a hammer and flatten the tubing on the swing set, and that would be my sword.
Taking his skills from playground to professional, you might say, happened overnight.
What was the dream?
So it was, I know it was the Holy Spirit was telling me, as plain as day, make chef knives. And I said, okay, I love making knives.
Middleton went to work and found customers in top chefs like James Beard award-winning.
It's thin.
Kwame Onwuachi.
The weight distribution is beautiful. So when you're holding it, it feels like you're in control. The grip also, it contours with your hand.
A feeling that's worth the sharp cost.
He's caring throughout the process of the knife on how it looks, how it actually like works in the kitchen.
Quentin Middleton is on the cutting edge, and he intends to stay there for a while.
My dream from day one was always to breathe life back into my community and be able to provide jobs. It started with somebody's idea. Why can't it start with me one knife at a time?
There's a character in a popular TV series, unquestionably on a roll. It's a delicious specialty sandwich. And Tracy Smith tells us it's the talk and taste of Chicago.
We're down six sausage pepper, five Greeks, and a ravioli. Let's go.
Last year, the FX series The Bear exploded off TV screens and into the hearts of foodies everywhere.
I'm waiting on those peppers, chef.
It's about an award-winning chef who comes back to run a Chicago sandwich stand after a death in the family.
Cindy, head in the game, are you kidding me? Are you?
But it's really about how brutally hard it is to run a restaurant.
Yes, lower your voice, please.
Thank you. So sorry, guys, thank you for your patience.
The crazy sandwich shop is fiction, but it's inspired by something you can actually touch and eat.
All right, buddy, what can we get you?
Let me get four beef.
This is Mr. Beef.
Juicy?
Yes, sir.
The place was both the inspiration for The Bear.
Here's a Polish and a mod stick.
And the place where they shot the pilot. Walking in here is like stepping into the show.
Here, hot beef, buddy.
Hot beef.
And for the hardcore Italian beef eaters who line up day after day, it does not disappoint. With a technique that took him 30 years to perfect, sandwich maker Freddie McGroom is poetry in motion. He literally flings the beef into a sliced roll and then dunks the whole thing in the pan juices, so there's not a dry bite in the house. Then it gets a few peppers and a double wrap in wax paper to keep it all together.
There you go.
Until you can make it back to the elegant dining room, find a seat, and devour. Oh yeah, it's messy, but people come from all over for this. And I mean all over.
I'm not a great meat lover, and I ate so much, literally in about 30 seconds. He's never seen me devour a sandwich like I did. I'm afraid to say it was delicious.
Seems it's always been that way. The first Italian beef is said to have been invented in the early 1900s by Italian immigrants who would make a cheaper cut of meat more palatable by roasting it, slicing it thin, and serving it up on Italian bread. Chicago native Joe Zaccaro started Mr. Beef in 1979 as a sandwich stand with a tiny kitchen and a tiny menu. And in 44 years, neither has changed that much. In fact, the biggest change to Mr. Beef happened last March.
New at 10, the founder of the River North staple, Mr. Beef, has died, according to family.
Joe Zaccaro died suddenly at age 69. His son, Christopher, was devastated, but he stepped up to run the family business.
We take time kind of peeling this off.
Which is booming now like never before.
We've been very blessed here because of that show, and it's all because of that show.
That show, The Bear, was created by one of Chris Zaccaro's grade school buddies, Christopher Storer. And when Zaccaro first heard about it, he scoffed.
So he'd said to me, I'm starting to write this show, and I guarantee it's going to be based on this place. And I did say condescendingly to him, I'm like, oh, I bet it'll be a big hit.
You said that?
I did say that. Now I'm eating my words.
We got issues. This arcuate's painted.
The show gave Zaccaro his own shot at stardom, with a cameo opposite series lead Jeremy Allen White.
Add this. What am I, a coin star?
That's like 300, Gigi.
300 plus what?
But for now, he's keeping his day job.
So we start off with this in the morning.
And keeping his father's legacy alive.
Each beef stand has a special ingredient they add to their
beef.
So I can't tell you what mine is.
He didn't tell me, but it wasn't all that hard to guess. The secret ingredient at Mr. Beef is family.
I'm blessed. I was blessed to have that man in my life. And I'm blessed with it. And that's all. Forget about all this. Forget about the restaurant, whatever it was. I was just happy that that was my father.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You guys have a good day.
You too.
Thank you.
Jim Axelrod has the story of a lawyer with a taste for the truth.
And it's not giving people what they expect.
His name is Spencer Sheehan, but his work has provided him with quite the catchy nickname.
Most of the vanilla flavoring here was chemical.
The Vanilla Vigilante. Perhaps the most prolific consumer class action attorney in the country, Sheehan is also the smokehouse sheriff.
These almonds have never come within a foot of a smokehouse.
And the olive oil avenger.
The amount of olive oil in this is actually quite small.
He carved out a unique niche, suing over deceptions he says he sees in the aisles of the grocery store. Hundreds of cases in the last few years alone, including a suit against the makers of A&W root beer.
They were selling a product labeled as made with aged vanilla, when in fact, almost all of the flavoring in that product was not from aged vanilla or any kind of vanilla, but actually from a chemical known as ethyl vanillin.
He didn't claim the chemical vanilla made the drink less healthy, just that consumers paid more expecting the real thing.
Do you believe your clients have been harmed?
They have been harmed. Now, of course, it's not, a car accident. It's somebody who was misled.
So there's a general federal statute that says when you sell or label food or advertise food, you have to be truthful. You can't be fraudulent and you can't be deceptive.
Jacob Gerson, the director of Harvard Law School's Food Law Lab, says it's all a matter of what a reasonable consumer would believe. And that in a world of too many regulations and too few regulators to enforce them, Spencer Sheehan's lawsuits help determine that.
So what do food companies think of the type of cases an attorney like Spencer Sheehan files against them?
They hate them. They think they're frivolous. They think that no reasonable consumer would actually believe the things that he's asserting they believe in these cases.
One out of every four or five cases that you are filing, some judge is saying there's no merit to it.
And, I think that's quite an unfortunate thing.
But are you out there pressing for some sort of justice for the consumer, or have you stumbled upon a pretty good business model?
Personally, I don't think in terms of business model. I happen to enjoy what I do.
Sheehan's cases against Blue Diamond, Smokehouse Almonds, and Country Crock Plant Butter are ongoing. Those companies say all their labeling is truthful, accurate, and FDA compliant. The makers of A&W Root Beer say the same, but have agreed to settle Sheehan's case for $15 million. They say to avoid further litigation. That's a few bucks each to the plaintiffs and a few million to the lawyers. But the real aged vanilla is no longer used.
The members of the class, people who get to share in the settlement, how much money did they get?
They might get anywhere from $5 to $25, depending on their proof of purchase.
The attorneys make millions.
We're the stopgap, and after us, it's nothing. And all we're doing is just trying to hold things back a little bit, just try to make things a little bit better and to give consumers a little bit more transparency when it comes to what they're buying.
So the windfall from the cases financially absolutely goes to lawyers that bring them. That should make us feel a little uneasy. But compared to a world where the cases are never brought, I think this world looks a lot better.
A world where lawsuits filed by the vanilla vigilante and others like him keep defining and refining where the line is when it comes to food producers getting us to pull their items off the shelves and into our carts.
Now, is that a terrible thing? I don't think that's such a terrible thing. Because when a consumer reads vanilla or made with vanilla, we actually want to know what most people think that means. The best world would be where people get what they think they're buying and then eat what they think they're eating.
You say you're trying to eat less meat? Faith Saley knows just the place.
Let's go. Thank you.
When you step inside this Atlanta-based restaurant,
what's up, Slats?
The greeting might catch you off guard.
Hey, Slats.
Hi, Slats.
Yeah, you'll hear that word a lot.
When people come here and they don't quite get it, how do you explain it to them?
They know that we're going to call you a slut. And by slut, I mean it's a term of endearment, right? I mean that in the most respectful way.
We got the biggest slut cake out the building.
They know that we are going to have a party with you, dance with you. So when they get here, they're not necessarily just coming for the food. They're coming for the experience.
Possibly I could get a picture with
you. Absolutely.
35-year-old Pinky Cole is the founder of the plant-based fast food chain Slutty Vegan, which she started in 2018.
I've merged the two most pleasurable experiences in life, and that's sex and that's food. Yeah. But then once you start peeling back the layer, you realize there's a pure intention and a mission-driven movement behind it all.
That mission, she says, is to change the conversation around vegan food by making what she calls vegan comfort food more mainstream and accessible.
One, you're saving the planet, right? You're helping the carbon footprint. You're saving the animals. This is the first step to changing your consciousness about the food that you consume.
Is this like a gateway into veganism?
It really challenges the narrative that you cannot have good vegan food.
Yeah.
Right? Like, yes, you can.
While 5% of the U.S. population is either vegan or vegetarian, Pinky hopes that her signature burgers, with racy names like Menage a Trois and One Night Stand, will win over meat eaters, who currently make up about 70% of her customers.
You cannot believe that it's vegan, that it's plant-based.
You can't eat all of it.
Okay, so eat one more bite, and then we got to go to the next, because you got to taste everything.
But the taste of success came with a side of uncertainty back when she was Aisha Cole growing up in Baltimore.
The day that I was born, my father was sentenced to 30 years in prison. By society's standards, I'm not supposed to be here. I grew up in a single-parent household. I got kicked out of high school. Like, I am not supposed to be what you see.
Her new book chronicles her improbable rise, how her first restaurant burned down and she had to start from scratch in a food truck. But her luck changed when that food truck fed a famous customer and created a viral sensation.
And we went and fed Snoop Dogg, and the rest was history.
Last month, she served up some hard-earned wisdom at her alma mater, Clark Atlanta University.
It is okay to fail, because failing is not failing at all. It's finding the aspiration in the losses. Got it?
Where she'd previously paid off the tuition debt of 30 students.
I am now becoming the person that is giving opportunity instead of begging for one, you know? And to be able to say that is big.
This fall, she made the Time 100 Next list. By her side is husband Derek Hayes, who happens to be the founder and CEO of Big Dave's Cheesesteaks.
The irony, right? Like, these two things aren't supposed to go together.
But that's what's good about it, because we show you from two different lenses, two different outlooks of the way we do food, and I think that's what makes it magical.
And she recently brought that magic to Baltimore, her hometown, to announce a new restaurant, her 14th and counting.
Are there any doctors in the audience? Just in case I go into labor.
Pinky Cole says she lives by the motto, lift as you climb. And she's doing just that, one sloppy bite at a time.
You like that one night stand?
I'm aligned with my purpose when I'm eating.
You are aligned with your purpose.
No, I like them all because of the shrimp in that one.
I got friends in high.
eat, drink, and be merry. Sunday morning's food issue. Here again is Jane Pauley.
Famous for any number of hits, Garth Brooks has plenty of friends, and he's inviting them all to stop by the new spot he's opening in Nashville.
This is where you get to belly up, if that's the word you like to use.
The way you stand at the bar, you just, it was great. I look kind of authentic here, don't I?
Bars and honky-tonks already pulsing with music at midday line Nashville's Lower Broadway. Make room for one more.
Don't want to be egotistical. Friends in Low Places, for me, is a chapter in country music. It needs to be here.
Named after Brooks' 1990 country hit,
we took the floors out.
The Friends in Low Places Bar and Honky Tonk was still a work in progress last month.
What is the difference between a bar and a honky tonk?
A bar is a place usually where just locals come, like you saw Cheers. Honky tonk's probably got a dance floor, a little bit bigger, right? It's kind of like a dance hall.
So you'll be doing some two-step here?
I don't know if it's two-step anymore. Then you're going to move with me wherever I push or pull you, okay?
Uh-huh.
One slide, two slide, then this one. Then your other foot, okay? That's a two-step. And you just keep doing it over and over again. You were a good student.
Well, it'll make a better still picture than
the 61-year-old Oklahoman was a new name in town some 30 years ago.
Looking back.
On the road to becoming the best-selling solo recording artist of all time. 157 million albums and counting.
Give it to me. If you're lucky enough to get to sell some records in this town, you owe this town. How can I pay back? Well, if you come down here on Lower Broadway and there's not a Friends in Low Places, are you kidding me?
This is going to be a honky-tonk, and people are going to have a really good time, and you're going to serve every kind of beer.
Yes, ma'am. We're going to serve everybody.
And times being what they are, that stirred some people up.
You're going to serve every kind of beer to everybody, and that's controversial.
I think if you want division on this planet at this time, talk about unity. Talk about love. What's our other option?
But you've got some fans who are thinking, you know, Garth Brooks, is he with us or is he with them?
I'm with love. Come on this ship or not. But love's big enough for all of us. They say the hardest question on the planet is, why are we down here? That's the easiest one. We're down here for each other. That's why there's more than just one of us down here. So I love that. And I kind of love the differences because that's the fun part of it.
The other parts were on his mind when we first met 30 years ago. In 1992, after rocketing to the top of the music scene, he didn't like what he saw.
If it wasn't for the people that come see me and my love for them, I would have been out of this business a year and a half ago.
You were a man with the world by the tail, and you wanted to let go of it. You were talking about quitting.
100%.
100% didn't believe you would, but you were serious.
Oh, very serious.
Of course he didn't. And 7 years later was named Artist of the Decade. And then he did it. In 2000, he and wife Sandy were splitting up. And he walked away to be a full-time dad to their three daughters.
So that's when life kind of began for me. I thought the 90s were rocking. 90s couldn't hold a candle to get to be a dad for those kids for the 2000s.
Inspired by his own childhood in Yukon, Oklahoma, the youngest of Raymond and Colleen's six kids, one girl and five boys who shared a bedroom.
Your childhood home sounds like the home equivalent of a clown car because there were so many
nuts.
Of you in a small, tell me about that.
And we were blended. That's a great thing. So mom had three kids, dad had one. And they came together and had two more. But half or step was never, you never got to use that.
And there's a lot of music.
Tons of music. Life's better with music in it.
And every kind of music.
James Taylor and Creedence, Janis Joplin. Dad was listening to Haggard Jones. Buck Owens' mom was listening to Belafonte, Mahalia Jackson. And then on my own, I discovered George Strait. That day changed everything for me.
You heard what?
I don't know. You hear that voice that you trust. You hear that voice you sing and you go, man, whatever that is, makes me smile. And then when you get behind a guitar and you're like, give me a bottle, all of a sudden your bones and everything goes, hey, we like this. Whatever this is, we like it. And then it's almost like breathing. So you find yourself singing all the time.
When his youngest daughter went off to college, Brooks went back on the road. Country music artist Trisha Yearwood by his side. They were married in 2005. The fans were still there, more than ever. He's scaled back a bit with a Las Vegas residency, but beginning a new radio venture.
You're right in the heart of it.
And with the imminent opening of the Friends in Low Places Bar and Honky Tonk, Garth Brooks is savoring a full circle moment.
You might be interviewing the luckiest, most blessed guy on this planet. My children are healthy. They're on their way. Miss Yearwood's happy. I'm hoping. And then hopefully the music are bringing people together, and they're using it to celebrate. They're using it to mourn. They're using it to unite. How does it get better than that?
For many of us, tinned fish means a can of tuna in the cupboard. But there's a lot more to it than that, as we learn from Luke Can-Do Burbank.
Let's start with the Deans.
Let's start with the Deans. Why not? The classic tinned fish.
For years, sardines have been a bit of a joke.
A double, triple-decker sardine and marshmallow fudge sandwich.
Would you say that sardines need the most reputational repair?
I think they do because
Americans?
Of all those cartoons.
But that's not how they think of them in places like Spain and Portugal, where fish in a can is something they proudly serve in restaurants, as Becca Milstein found out.
I had lived abroad in Spain in college and had gone into these beautiful conservatorias and saw rows and rows of beautiful tins of fish, and nothing like that exists in the U.S.
Milstein wants to change that with her company, Fishwife, just one of a number of outfits hoping to convince people to spend serious money on not canned fish, but tinned fish.
It's a little more delicate, a little more special, and a little more premium.
Anna Heasel wrote an entire cookbook about it. Well, as much as you can write a cookbook about pre-cooked fish. According to a market research company, last year, tinned fish sales rose to $2.7 billion, driven largely by younger consumers.
The tinned fish hashtag on TikTok now, I think, has like more than 91 million views. It is a very social, very visual hobby, but there's also kind of this aha moment when you pull back the tin and you get to see the actual handiwork that went into packing all of those mussels or anchovies or sardines.
That's Wes Taylor's handiwork you might be looking at, or at least the people who work in his cannery in Bay Center, Washington.
The facility like ours is unique. It's crafty, it's artisanal, it's small. We're not using heavy equipment. What we're doing is focusing on highest quality and not necessarily a high volume.
Becca Milstein reached out to Taylor, desperate to find someone who could put the relatively small amounts of sustainably harvested seafood that she sells, sometimes down by the seashore, into cans.
Give it
a whiff. I'm smelling it. It smells very fresh. It doesn't smell overly fishy.
Yeah, so it's very, very, very simple. It's just sardines and some preserved lemon, so it's actually packed fresh and preserved in the canning process.
What do you say when folks say, well, if I'm gonna pay $17 for a piece of fish, I can just go to the grocery store and buy an actual piece of fresh fish?
There's so much tinned seafood now that you can buy that ironically is almost a fresher way of experiencing that seafood because sardines are fished out of the water and in some cases canned within hours.
With their long shelf life, Heasel says one way to think about tinned fish is like a nice bottle of wine you save for a special occasion.
I am very excited about a tin that I just got of barnacles. They look like dinosaur legs.
But seriously, is this all just a fad? Becca Milstein says no. She named her company Fishwife for the industrious, tough women who've sold fish in the past, something she's hoping to do long into the future.
It's something that people have been eating for hundreds of years. So the trend that we're experiencing right now is the beginning of the new era of tin fish.
Many consider it the paper of record. But for more and more foodies, the New York Times is also the paper of recipes. Here's Kella Fasene.
Now we're getting somewhere.
When it comes to turkey, Melissa Clark is an expert.
Every year I get so many emails, letters. I have to make my turkey ahead and drive it to my daughters, my son-in-law, my cousin, my aunt.
She's an award-winning cookbook author and a food columnist at the New York Times.
So I brought this up at one of our meetings and my editor said, okay, go with it. Oh yeah, look at that. That looks really good. Great.
Ahead of Thanksgiving, she showed us her latest recipe for turkey, reheated turkey.
That looks really juicy. That's great. And I'm no expert, but if you served that to me, I would have no idea that was reheated. Did you grow up cooking?
I did grow up cooking.
And where did the recipes come from?
When I was a kid, they were Julia Child.
Splattered with food.
Yes. Oh my God, those cookbooks. All the pages are stuck together. You can't even open them anymore.
Over the years, Clark has contributed more than 1,000 recipes to the paper.
The New York Times began publishing
after an investigation by the New York Times.
Of course, the New York Times isn't primarily known for recipes.
In a bombshell report, the New York Times obtained...
The story was first reported by the New York Times.
The paper has nearly 10 million subscribers. But if you want all the recipes, you'll have to pay a little extra.
So these days, recipes are an important part of the New York Times business model, aren't they?
Yeah, that is true.
Emily Weinstein oversees cooking and food coverage at the Times.
There are a million people who just have cooking, and there are millions more who have access to cooking because they are all in on the New York Times bundle.
I see. And at a basic price of about $5 a month, that's pretty good business.
Seems that way to me.
The NYT Cooking app launched in 2014. The paper started charging extra for it 3 years later. It now lists more than 21,000 recipes, from a peanut butter and pickle sandwich to venison medallions with blackberry sage sauce.
Turkey chickpea with baharat.
Oh, that sounds good.
Okay.
Dozens of recipes are added each month, and the subscribers respond, sometimes energetically.
We have this enormous fire hose of feedback in the form of our comment section, right? We know right away whether or not people liked the recipe, whether they thought it worked, what changes they made to it.
I actually do read a lot of the notes. The bad ones, because I want to learn how to improve.
Sure.
You know, how to write a recipe that's stronger and more foolproof. And then the good ones, because it makes me warms my heart. It's so gratifying to read that, oh my God, you know, this recipe that I put out there, it worked and people loved it and the meal was good.
Each recipe the Times publishes must be cooked.
This guy's not ready yet, so this guy needs more time.
And recooked.
We are on turkeys number 9 and 10, by the way.
Which might explain why Melissa Clark is taking this Thanksgiving off.
This year I'm going to someone else's house for Thanksgiving.
And they're making you a turkey? They must be nervous.
Not at all.
I guarantee you that home chef right now is already stressing about this.
He has sent me a couple of texts about it, yeah.
As you think about dessert this holiday season, why not choose one that does the work for you?
What is it?
It's a bunt.
A bunt?
Bunt.
There's a hole in this cake.
What is a bunt pan?
It's a baking pan with a hole in the middle. It's got a nice design around the outside, and the inside hole allows the heat to get to the center of the cake.
You don't have to be a fancy baker to bake a fancy cake. Buy a bundt pan, and it's all decorated and ready to go.
Susan Brust and David Dahlquist should know. For them, it's a family recipe. They're the children of the bundt's founders, H. David and Dottie Dahlquist, who developed the first pan here at Nordicware in Minneapolis. They were tasked with recreating bakeware used for the Kugelhopf, a traditional European ring-shaped cake with a hole. The Dahlquists reimagined the design and its name.
Originally, the word was bunt,
In German, Bund refers to a gathering.
Then D in German is pronounced like a T. And so my father decided to put the T after the D. So he spelled it B-U-N-D-T.
75 million bunts have been sold since the Bundt birth in 1950. But its circle of fans grew after it was featured in the 1966 Pillsbury Bake Off. Nowadays, the Bundt comes in all shapes and sizes, and there's an abundance of uses beyond cake.
This is an example of a one-pan meal in a Bundt pan.
Jenny Dahlquist is part of the third generation baking the Bundt.
There are carrots and potatoes in the bottom of there, and you literally put the chicken on top of the cone, which funnels the heat up into the chicken.
But however you use the Bundt, Susan Brust is sure you'll treasure it forever.
It's one of those iconic things that is multi-generational. Everybody's got a good story about it. It's something you'll pass on to your children, and they'll pass on to their children.
Thank you for listening. Please join us when our trumpet sounds again next Sunday morning.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to CBS Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Hi, everyone. I'm Drew Barrymore, host of, well, The Drew Barrymore Show. And welcome to the Drew Barrymore Show podcast. Stream from the car, the train, the shower. Wait, what? That doesn't work. Well, you never know. Whatever you're into, just take a moment to see the sunny side of life with us. I can't wait to go on this journey together. Hear the new episodes of the Drew Barrymore Show podcast every day, Monday through Friday. Listen on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.